From Erie to Harrisburg, Williamsport to Pittsburgh, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, as 2021 draws to a close, David Taylor is joined by Rebecca Euler and Stephen Bloom for a Capital Watch look back at the events and issues that made news this past year. And as we celebrate the joys of the Christmas season, I'll have our traditional Lincoln Radio Journal reading of the biblical account of the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. The crowded field of candidates for the Republican nomination for governor in the upcoming May primary is set to get larger in early January. State Senator Doug Mastriano, who gained a statewide following last year, fighting Governor Tom Wolf's draconian orders related to the COVID-19 pandemic, says he has reached his fundraising goal and will formally announce his candidacy at a rally on January 8th. And former U.S. Representative Melissa Hart, who served in a southwestern Pennsylvania congressional district for many years, has scheduled a special announcement for mid-January and will formally enter the race. Over a dozen candidates are now vying for the chance to fill the chair being vacated by Governor Tom Wolf, who is term-limited and cannot seek re-election. On the Democratic side, the race for the nomination to run for the U.S. Senate seat of retiring U.S. Senator Pat Toomey is heating up. The contest already features a clash of heavyweights, including Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, Congressman Connor Lamb of Allegheny County, and Montgomery County Commissioner Valerie Arcush. But lesser-known candidates are beginning to make noise, including State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta of Philadelphia, who released an internal poll this past week that unsurprisingly showed him with a pathway to the nomination, that assuming he raises enough money to get his message out. According to the Center Square, Pennsylvania's unemployment rate continued to decline in November, shaving 0.3 of a percentage point since October. It now stands at 5.7%. However, Penns Woods continues to lag the national unemployment rate, which is now 4.2% and also fell again last month. Also, the state's labor force participation rate now at its lowest level since 1987, this despite the fact 13,500 jobs were added in November. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, two constitutional amendments, and a job-crushing radical environmental plan were among the many issues to take center stage in 2021. Our Capital Watch crew is here with a look back at the year that was. Host David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation.
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. In the studio with me, your Capital Watch All-Stars, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to be with you.
Thank you, David.
Outstanding. And Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, thank you for being on the program.
Great to be back again. Thank you.
Well, we want to wish everybody a very happy Christmas, that we're in the Christmas season, and I hope everybody is having a wonderful holiday, safe travels, and all the joys that come with this time of year. And as you know, it comes with this time of year, it's the time to look back on the year that was, 2021. And just, you know, I don't know if you guys have had the chance to sort of mull what we saw over the last 12 months. But, you know, looking back, the first thing that comes to me, like the most notable thing, was the result in the May primary election where Pennsylvania's voters approved an amendment to the Constitution to curb the governor's emergency powers, powers that Governor Tom Wolf is widely viewed as having abused. That was a very consequential action. We haven't seen anything like that for a long time. And so looking back at 2021, I would say that was like the biggest thing that happened.
It was truly historic, David. And you know, we have to think about what drove that. And really what drove that was Governor Wolf's rather arrogant and extreme overreach in the way he used the powers of his office as governor. And we saw that in particular manifesting itself, for example, with respect to his decision to arbitrarily require certain businesses to be closed, not based on any scientific principles or any health-related reason, but just names on a list. One store that sells plants and flowers and garden supplies would be allowed to be open. In the next town over, they'd be required to be closed in the same type of store, or even down the block.
Right.
There was this very arbitrary and very destructive shutdown principle that the governor was using that, again, wasn't tied to any real objective standards,
and
there was no process.
He didn't. It's like
there was no appeal.
There was no appeal, and that he didn't ask the stakeholders. Like, you know, I mean, it would be nice to be, you know, to be informed to say, hey, how would this play out if I did it this way? But that Wolf didn't ask. He just handed it down from on high, regardless of the consequences, like indifferent to the consequences.
And there was literally no due process involved. It was an arbitrary decision. It was like an act of an authoritarian,
yeah,
or
a tyrant,
a monarch. It was not what we are expecting in a system of checks and balances in the constitutional system that we have. And so that drove the energy that I think actually ended up being the thing that pushed these constitutional amendments through the process and into an amazing and historic winning vote on primary election day.
Yeah, I agree. When I think back over this past year, I really think it's sort of two themes. It's that executive overreach that Steve was talking about. And we saw it in a number of places, not just on the COVID and handling the COVID pandemic, but also on REGI, for example, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, yeah, where the governor went, you know, full throttle with executive authority and pushed it as far as he could. And also the bridge tolling plan, where he's proposing to toll 9 bridges across the interstates and really with a reckless executive abandon, I would say. And so that's one theme. And then the other theme is the reaction to that. And the constitutional amendments that passed in May were a reaction to that. I think people are realizing that is not, like Steve said, not the way that things should work. And then the next thing that happened in the fall election was the election of Kevin Brobson to the state Supreme Court, which I would say is another indication that people, you know, are reacting to that overreach, because Justice Brobson was an excellent candidate and one that made a case for the proper and appropriate role of government. And I think so, sort of two themes there. One was the overreach and the other was reaction to it.
Yeah, yeah, no question, no question. And I just, you know, again, we all regret that it would come to this, that we, you know, again, our whole system is premised on, you know, elected officials, you know, back and forth, give and take, the different branches of government, you know, communicating and responding one to another. But, you know, the lone wolf approach that the governor has taken has really been the hallmark of his tenure. But isn't it stunning even that in the face of that the governor is completely unchastened? Like, okay, you've just been rebuked by the voters who have taken away your emergency powers, and it's like it's just more cowbell.
Well, that's so true. And I think back, as you mentioned that, to the mask mandate for schools this past fall, where the governor at first had said that he doesn't have the authority to
Correct.
Put that mask
Correct.
Mandate into effect. And I think
leave
that
it up
was
to the local jurisdiction.
Right.
Yes.
I think that was a reaction to the constitutional amendment that passed and him, you know, sort of recognizing that there's a limit to his authority. But then
– yeah.
Because the schools chose not to, you know, go his way, the way he would have preferred, he all of a sudden decided that, you know what, there is room for a mandate here, and I'm going to put it into effect. So, he, like you said, he just really is going full throttle on the executive authority. There's no stopping it, and he's doubling down.
He won't stop himself. He shows no self-restraint, but that he's challenging everybody else to stop him. Essentially, he's saying, I will do whatever you cannot stop me from doing.
That's right. Yes.
Because in the latest shutdown that Rebecca just referred to in the schools, the mandate in the schools, the state Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you can't do that, Governor, or
yeah.
Secretary of Health, you can't do that.
Right.
She was acting obviously
on behalf
under,
of the administration.
Right. She's a member of the administration. And so there again, you saw the system of checks and balances being reestablished. And even with a court system in Pennsylvania, especially at the Supreme Court level, that's often unfriendly to the general principles of constitutional freedoms, this court spoke and said, no, you can't put that in place. You don't have the authority to do so.
The governor said, I don't have this power, therefore I'm not going to have a mandate. Let the 500 school districts figure it out for themselves. It was only after those respective school boards went through the agonizing process of interacting with the public and all of the, you know, grievances and hurt feelings and all that stuff of doing the difficult work of making local decisions, and then after the fact, for the governor to have rendered all of that pointless, like, that's just insult to injury.
Just removing the power that those local school boards were exercising under their own authorities, just completely erasing it.
Yeah, but yes, Steve is correct that the courts intervened, and that is heartening that they did, in fact, establish the appropriate limits to say, no, the governor can't just do this on his own. But I'll take one more whack at Governor Wolf before I let that go. So that the governor has exercised his veto, he's issued, I think, now more vetoes than any governor since Milton Schaap, who himself was notorious for exactly that. And that one of the things that Governor Wolf vetoed in 2021 was liability protections, safe harbor, good faith liability protections for employers regarding COVID. And that, you know, representing the manufacturers, that was especially important to us because when the pandemic emerged, that the governor had a call to action that manufacturers should retool to make personal protection equipment or anything regarding the medical field with ventilators, what have you, or for manufacturers already making those things to increase your operational tempo to crank out more units. In either case, whether you're retooling or you're accelerating production, you're taking a risk. You're sticking your neck out that something could go wrong, expose you to legal liability later on. And so, again, in good faith, for those who responded to that effort, that the General Assembly passed legislation giving those protections. And just again to note, the governor could have done that on his own in his own executive order, but he chose not to. But then the legislature passed this. It went to the governor and he vetoed it. I mean, just again, I would argue that that's extreme bad faith on his part. And that this is what has shaped the environment in which these, you know, the public policy debate is occurring in Harrisburg.
Totally agree. And we were supportive of that COVID liability protection as well, because as you know, it was our truckers who were delivering those manufactured goods. They were the ones who delivered the PPE, the ones who kept food on the shelves and then ultimately delivered the vaccines. And to not have liability protection for COVID was just extremely disappointing and upsetting that he chose to veto that. So now we're in the midst of a supply chain crisis and we need our truckers more than ever. Would have been helpful to have that.
Yeah.
And all at a time when the environment for businesses is so unpredictable, it's been so challenging for so many businesses, and government in general has made a lot of noise about how they want to stand behind our entrepreneurs and our business sector, our employers, and make sure that through the uncertainties of this COVID epidemic that they will be able to continue to thrive. And yet Governor Wolf turns around and does something like that. That's literally a betrayal to the very sector that they always talk about wanting to see grow in Pennsylvania. And in fact, they're hurting it.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. So looking back on 2021, what are the other things that come to mind as being like the big stories worth remembering?
One of the really big stories that's, I think, growing, even as we sit here at the end of the year, is the change in the way parents are interacting with the school system.
Yes.
Under the COVID crisis, because of the various shutdowns and mandates and confusing data and all those things that have been swirling around, many, many kids have not had access to a proper education. You've seen district after district where they went virtual and they lost track of a huge chunk of their student population. They weren't logging on. No one knew where they were. They were just gone out of the system. Now that this has been going on for almost 2 years, some of the long-term effects of that are starting to kick in. And what you're seeing is a dramatic shift away from the government-run monopoly of the traditional district school system with teachers who are members of these public sector unions like the PSEA or the NFT. And you're seeing a sea change. Before the COVID epidemic came on, roughly 75% of Pennsylvania's student population would attend traditional district schools, the schools assigned to them by their zip code. Correct. Under the old system. But already before the pandemic, about 25% of kids had other alternatives that they were utilizing. That could be charter schools, that could be private schools, that could be using the Educational Improvement Tax Credit Program to enable students who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford those alternatives to get access to those schools. It could be homeschooling. It could be, you know, special little educational pods, pandemic pods they're now called. But there was already a movement. About 25% of the kids weren't part of that traditional school system. Now we're seeing the data start to emerge from places all over the country, including places in Pennsylvania. There's been a mass exodus from those district schools. And the educational system is changing, and it's changing in a way that is going to be really beneficial for students, because now families are realizing they need to take an active role and choose for their child the best educational alternative, not just send the kid to the zip code assigned school that may or may not be a good school. So we're seeing an emergence of consumer choice in the public school environment. And even this past year in Pennsylvania, there was a large increase in the Educational Improvement Tax Credit program by $40 million. One of the largest increases in that program ever, and the largest in any state where there was a Democratic governor in office. So the General Assembly passed the bill, and they passed it as part of a budget bill that Governor Wolf felt compelled to sign, even though he didn't like elements of it.
Right.
And we saw that historic expansion of school choice here in Pennsylvania. And that's just a trend that's continuing. More and more legislation has been introduced over the past year to give parents more choice, more control in the process. And we've seen an active hunger for that amongst families all across PA.
Right, because the waiting list is still so long for kids who
literally haven't 40,000 kids on waiting lists in Pennsylvania for tax credit program. About that same number, if not more, waiting for access to public charter schools. And homeschooling is growing like crazy. So there's just this a sea change taking place that I don't think anyone would have predicted necessarily. Maybe it wouldn't have come about without the restrictions involved, that the government got so over-involved in the pandemic and overreaching in a way, using their governmental power. But it's certainly one of, again, the silver linings of this change that we're experiencing.
And one more detail, Steve, that I'll add to your excellent commentary there is that, you know, you had the physical school districts, the conventional public schools, attempt to do distance learning, online programming, when they had no knowledge base, no experience doing it. And as a result, it was really pretty poor. For those Pennsylvania charter schools that are virtual schools, that are structured around delivering educational services online, that a lot of families have said, look, if my kids are going to be subjected to virtual learning, we want to go to a school that actually knows how to do it well. And so this is why you've seen actually some pretty significant growth in Pennsylvania's online charter schools as well.
Right, which have been, again, a model for doing it right. When you do virtual education, it's like any other education. It's an environment that takes some skills.
Yeah, it's a specific discipline.
And in your setting, it's a profession. And Pennsylvania cyber charter schools, in large measure, have been doing an outstanding job of that, but now they were under the gun because there was a sudden new demand, and they've been enrolling students like crazy, and it's working. The parents are happy with that, and many of those parents are going to be staying in those cyber charter schools, even if their schools go back to the old-fashioned hours that they used to keep.
Yes, yes. So looking back, I would say that the education reform, the progress that we've seen, the change in attitude is a positive story. There's another positive story that I wanted to share that's been really underreported, which is, so because Pennsylvania enacted, it was Act 66 of 2020, which was a production-based tax credit for the value chain from methane, which is natural gas, that this changed the business environment in Pennsylvania. And so the announcement was made that a Texas company called NOSERA is going to make an investment in Luzerne County of $6 billion to create a facility that's going to take Pennsylvania natural gas and convert it into a zero carbon automotive fuel. It will not require any of our vehicles to be altered in any way. You can pump it exactly like you do gasoline, but that this plant is coming to Luzerne County. It's going to be, again, many thousands of construction jobs just to erect it. It's the dawn of a new industry for Pennsylvania. So it's really exciting to see that kind of economic dynamism, to see Pennsylvania energy being manifested in this way that's going to, you know, help consumers, and it's going to help the environment too.
I think that's wonderful. And I'm especially happy to see alternatives in transportation fuel. I worry that sometimes we're a little too focused on the state and nationally as well on electric vehicles, when there are real solutions that alternative fuels that are, you know, coming from the U.S. and in this case from Pennsylvania, which I think is fantastic. Because another takeaway I think from this year is the supply chain crisis that was a result of, you know, the lockdowns and a lot of the pandemic issues around the world. It has really shined a light on how much we're dependent on supplies, materials, you know, everything throughout the supply chain and all of our manufacturers and everything. We're really interdependent with a lot of other countries.
Yes.
To the extent that we can bring some of those industries home and focus on using the resources we have here in Pennsylvania, I think that that's critical. And that project in Luzerne County is a great example of how we can do more of that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I do think that the effort to improve American competitiveness and to reshore not just vital industries, but also all of the inputs, the rolling stock, as it were, for all of those manufacturing processes. That's critical too, because, you know, this is the, you know, you brought up electric vehicles, Rebecca. The inputs to create those are inputs that do not exist in this country. You talk
right
about all of the minerals, all of the metals that we not only do not harvest those things or enough of them here, we have zero processing capacity, or at least minuscule processing capacity. So even if we harvested those elements here at home, we'd still have to ship them to China, have them processed there, and then buy them back. This is not the path to security for our transportation infrastructure, the way we power our economy. We're essentially making ourselves dependent by outsourcing one of the most important roles in our economy.
Yeah, and I think the pandemic shined a really bright light on that issue, which hopefully our policymakers will work on addressing.
Well, that was the year that was. And as always, we're grateful to you, the listeners, for making us part of your conversation, part of your information about what's happening in your state government. And as I always say, representative self-government is not a spectator sport. Thank you for choosing to live life with your brain turned on and exercising your citizenship as Pennsylvanians and Americans. So with that, I'll thank all of you for listening, and I'll thank my team here. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and Commonwealth Foundation and all the good work you're doing there?
Thank you, David. They can go to commonwealthfoundation.org.
Outstanding. And Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you and your group and the stuff you're doing?
They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. From Steve and Rebecca and me, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Thanks for listening. And now a special Christmas message from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. And now, as we celebrate Christmas and the coming New Year, it is an appropriate time to reflect back upon that very first Christmas All too often, Christmas becomes simply the holidays, with the true meaning buried beneath the hurried shopping and other pressures of the season. So before we close, I would like to take a couple of minutes and read the account of the birth of Christ as written by the Apostle Luke. "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts, praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, Let us go now, even unto Bethlehem, and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste, and found Mary, and Joseph, and the babe, lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, as was told unto them." With this reminder of the true meaning of the Christmas season, our entire Lincoln Radio Journal family, Capital Watch panelists David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Matthew Briette, along with Community Benefit Spotlight host Joe Geiger, Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi of the Allegheny Institute Report, and commentator Ashley Klingensmith, join with our production assistant Joe Winters, administrative assistant Carol Henry, and our affiliate relations manager Tyler Henry, in extending to everyone our best wishes for a blessed Christmas, along with our hopes for peace, prosperity, and many blessings in the new year. We leave you now with the sounds of the season by our friend Joe Trojak at Progressive Studios. For Lincoln Radio Journal, I'm Loman Henry. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.